was the moment when Moncharmin opened the door on the passage and shouted, "A safety pin! Somebody give me a safety pin!" And we also know how, at the same moment, Rémy, who had no safety pin, was received by Moncharmin, while a boy procured the pin so eagerly longed for. And what happened was this. Moncharmin first locked the door again. Then he knelt down behind Richard's back. "I hope," he said, "that the notes are still there."
"So do I," said Richard.
"The real ones?" asked Moncharmin, resolved not to be had this time.
"Look for yourself," said Richard. "I refuse to touch them."
Moncharmin took the envelope from Richard's pocket and drew out the banknotes with a trembling hand, for this time, in order frequently to make sure of the presence of the notes, he had not sealed the envelope nor even fastened it. He felt reassured on finding that they were all there and quite genuine. He put them back in the tail pocket and pinned them with great care. Then he sat down behind Richard's coat-tails and kept his eyes fixed on them, while Richard, sitting at his writing-table, did not stir. "A little patience, Richard," said Moncharmin. "We have only a few minutes to wait. The clock will soon strike 12. Last time we left at the last stroke of 12.
"Oh, I shall have all the patience necessary."
The time passed, slow, heavy, mysterious, stifling. Richard tried to laugh. "I shall end by believing in the omnipotence of the ghost," he said. "Just now, don't you find something uncomfortable, disquieting, alarming in the atmosphere of this room?"
"You're quite right," said Moncharmin, who was really impressed.
"The ghost," continued Richard in a low voice, as though fearing lest he should be overheard by invisible ears. "The ghost. Suppose, all the same, it were a ghost who puts the magic envelopes on the table, who talks in Box 5, who killed Joseph Bouquet, who unhooked the chandelier, and who robs us. For after all, there is no one here except you and me, and if the notes disappear and neither you nor I have anything to do with it, well, we shall have to believe in the ghost.
In the ghost."
At that moment, the clock on the mantelpiece gave its warning click, and the first stroke of 12 struck. The two managers shuddered. The perspiration streamed from their foreheads. The 12th stroke sounded strangely in their ears. When the clock stopped, they gave a sigh and rose from their chairs.
"I think we can go now," said Moncharmin.
"I think so," Richard agreed.
"Before we go, do you mind if I look in your pocket?"
"But of course, Moncharmin, you must."
"Well?" he asked, as Moncharmin was feeling at the pocket.
"Well, I can feel the pin.
Of course, as you said, we can't be robbed without noticing it."
But Moncharmin, whose hands were still fumbling, bellowed, "I can feel the pin, but I can't feel the notes."
"Come, no joking, Moncharmin. This isn't the time for it."
"Well, feel for yourself." Richard tore off his coat. The two managers turned the pocket inside out. The pocket was empty. And the curious thing was that the pin remained, stuck in the same place. Richard and Moncharmin turned pale. There was no longer any doubt about the witchcraft.
"The ghost," muttered Moncharmin.
But Richard suddenly sprang upon his partner. "No one but you has touched my pocket. Give me back my 20,000 francs. Give me back my 20,000 francs.
"On my soul," sighed Moncharmin, who was ready to swoon, "on my soul I swear that I haven't got it."
Then somebody knocked at the door. Moncharmin opened it automatically, seemed hardly to recognize Mercier, his business manager, exchanged a few words with him without knowing what he was saying, and, with an unconscious movement, put the safety pin, for which he had no further use, into the hands of his bewildered subordinate. Chapter 18. The Commissary, the Viscount, and the Persian. The first words of the Commissary of Police, on entering the manager's office, were to ask after the missing prima donna. "Is Christine Daae here?"
"Christine Daae here?" echoed Richard. "No, why?"
As for Moncharmin, he had not the strength left to utter a word. Richard repeated, for the commissary and the compact crowd which had followed him into the office observed an impressive silence.
"Why do you ask if Christine Daae is here, Monsieur le Commissaire?"
"Because she has to be found," declared the commissary of police solemnly.
"What do you mean, she has to be found? Has she disappeared?"
"In the middle of the performance."
"In the middle of the performance? This is extraordinary.
Isn't it?
And what is quite as extraordinary is that you should first learn it from me.
Yes, said Richard, taking his head in his hands and muttering, what is this new business? Oh, it's enough to make a man send in his resignation. And he pulled a few hairs out of his moustache without even knowing what he was doing.
So she disappeared in the middle of the performance? He repeated.
Yes. She was carried off in the prison act, at the moment when she was invoking the aid of the angels, but I doubt if she was carried off by an angel.
And I am sure that she was.
Everybody looked round. A young man, pale and trembling with excitement, repeated, I am sure of it.
Sure of what? Asked Mifroy.
That Christine Daae was carried off by an angel, Monsieur le Commissaire, and I can tell you his name.
Aha, Monsieur le Vicomte de Chagny, so you maintain that Christine Daae was carried off by an angel of the opera, no doubt.
Yes, monsieur, by an angel of the opera, and I will tell you where he lives, when we are alone.
You are right, monsieur.
And the commissary of police, inviting Raoul to take a chair, cleared the room of all the rest, excepting the managers. Then Raoul spoke.
Monsieur le Commissaire, the angel is called Eric. He lives in the opera, and he is the angel of music.
The angel of music? Really? That is very curious. The angel of music.
And turning to the managers, Monsieur Mifroy asked, Have you an angel of music on the premises, gentlemen?
Richard and Moncharmin shook their heads without even speaking.
Oh, said the Viscount, those gentlemen have heard of the opera ghost.
Well, I am in a position to state that the opera ghost and the angel of music are one and the same person, and his real name is Eric.
Monsieur Mifroy rose and looked at Raoul attentively.
I beg your pardon, monsieur, but is it your intention to make fun of the law? And if not, what is all this about the opera ghost?
I say that these gentlemen have heard of him.
Gentlemen, it appears that you know the opera ghost.
Richard rose with the remaining hairs of his moustache in his hand.
No, Monsieur Commissary, no, we do not know him, but we wish that we did, for this very evening he has robbed us of 20,000 francs.
Then Richard turned a terrible look on Moncharmin, which seemed to say, Give me back the 20,000 francs or I'll tell the whole story.
Moncharmin understood what he meant, for, with a distracted gesture, he said, Oh, tell everything and have done with it.
As for Mifroy, he looked at the managers and at Raoul by turns, and wondered whether he had strayed into a lunatic asylum. He passed his hand through his hair.
A ghost, he said, who on the same evening carries off an opera singer and steals 20,000 francs, is a ghost who must have his hands very full. If you don't mind, we will take the questions in order. The singer first, the 20,000 francs after. Come, Monsieur de Chagny, let us try to talk seriously. You believe that Mademoiselle Christine Daae has been carried off by an individual called Eric. Do you know this person? Have you seen him?
Yes.
Where?
In a churchyard.
Monsieur Mifroy gave a start, began to scrutinize Raoul again, and said,
Of course, that's where ghosts usually hang out. And what were you doing in that churchyard?
Monsieur, said Raoul, I can quite understand how absurd my replies must seem to you, but I beg you to believe that I am in full possession of my faculties. The safety of the person dearest to me in the world is at stake. I should like to convince you in a few words, for time is pressing and every minute is valuable. Unfortunately, if I do not tell you the strangest story that ever was from the beginning, you will not believe me. I will tell you all I know about the opera ghost, Monsieur Commissary. Alas, I do not know much.
"'Never mind, go on,' exclaimed Richard and Moncharmin, suddenly greatly interested.
Unfortunately for their hopes of learning some detail that could put them on the track of their hoaxer, they were soon compelled to accept the fact that Monsieur Raoul de Chagny had completely lost his head. All that story about Perrault Guirec, death's heads, and enchanted violins could only have taken birth in the disordered brain of a youth mad with love. It was evident also that Mr. Commissary Mifroy shared their view, and the magistrate would certainly have cut short the incoherent narrative if circumstances had not taken it upon themselves to interrupt it. The door opened, and a man entered, curiously dressed in an enormous frock coat and a tall hat,
at once shabby and shiny, that came down to his ears. He went up to the commissary and spoke to him in a whisper. It was doubtless a detective come to deliver an important communication. During this conversation, Monsieur Mifroy did not take his eyes off Raoul. At last, addressing him, he said, "Monsieur, we have talked enough about the ghost. We will now talk about yourself a little, if you have no objection. You were to carry off Mademoiselle Christine Daae tonight?"
"Yes, Monsieur le Commissaire."
"After the performance?"
"Yes, Monsieur le Commissaire."
"All your arrangements were made?"
"Yes, Monsieur le Commissaire."
"The carriage that brought you was to take you both away. There were fresh horses in readiness at every stage."
"That is true, Monsieur le Commissaire."
"And nevertheless, your carriage is still outside the rotunda, awaiting your orders, is it not?"
"Yes, Monsieur le Commissaire."
"Did you know that there were three other carriages there, in addition to yours?"
"I did not pay the least attention."
"They were the carriages of Mademoiselle Sorelli, which could not find room in the Cour de l'Administration, of Carlotta, and of your brother, Monsieur le Comte de Chagny."
"Very likely."
"What is certain is that, though your carriage and Sorelli's and Carlotta's are still there, by the rotunda pavement, Monsieur le Comte de Chagny's carriage is gone."
"Well, this has nothing to say to—"
"I beg your pardon. Was not Monsieur le Comte opposed to your marriage with Mademoiselle Daae?"
"That is a matter that only concerns the family."
"You have answered my question. He was opposed to it." "And that was why you were carrying Christine Daae out of your brother's reach?" "Well, Monsieur de Chagny, allow me to inform you that your brother has been smarter than you. It is he who has carried off Christine Daae."
"Oh, impossible," moaned Raoul, pressing his hand to his heart.
"Are you sure?" "Immediately after the artist's disappearance, which was procured by means which we have still to ascertain, he flung into his carriage, which drove right across Paris at a furious pace."
"Across Paris?" asked poor Raoul, in a hoarse voice. "What do you mean by across Paris?"
"Across Paris and out of Paris, by the Brussels road."
"Oh," cried the young man, "I shall catch them." And he rushed out of the office.
"And bring her back to us," cried the commissary gaily.
"Ah, that's a trick worth two of the Angel of Music's."
And, turning to his audience, Monsieur Mifroy delivered a little lecture on police methods. "I don't know for a moment whether Monsieur le Comte de Chagny has really carried Christine Daae off or not. But I want to know, and I believe that at this moment no one is more anxious to inform us than his brother. And now he is flying in pursuit of him. He is my chief auxiliary. This, gentlemen, is the art of the police, which is believed to be so complicated and which, nevertheless, appears so simple as soon as you see that it consists in getting your work done by people who have nothing to do with the police." But Monsieur le Commissaire de Police, Mifroy, would not have been quite so satisfied with himself if he had known that the rush of his rapid emissary was stopped at the entrance to the very first corridor. A tall figure blocked Raoul's way.
"Where are you going so fast, Monsieur de Chagny?" asked a voice.
Raoul impatiently raised his eyes and recognized the astrakhan cap of an hour ago. He stopped.
"It's you," he cried in a feverish voice. "You, who know Eric's secrets and don't want me to speak of them. Who are you?"
"Well, you know who I am. I am the Persian."
Chapter 19. The Viscount and the Persian. Raoul now remembered that his brother had once shown him that mysterious person, of whom nothing was known except that he was a Persian, and that he lived in a little old-fashioned flat in the Rue de Rivoli. The man with the ebony skin, the eyes of jade, and the astrakhan cap bent over Raoul. "I hope, Monsieur de Chagny," he said, "that you have not betrayed Eric's secret."
"And why should I hesitate to betray that monster, sir?" Raoul rejoined haughtily, trying to shake off the intruder. "Is he your friend by any chance?"
"I hope that you said nothing about Eric, sir, because Eric's secret is also Christine Daae's, and to talk about one is to talk about the other."
"Oh, sir," said Raoul, becoming more and more impatient, "you seem to know about many things that interest me, and yet I have no time to listen to you."
"Once more, Monsieur de Chagny, where are you going so fast?"
"Well, can you not guess? To Christine Daae's assistance."
"Then, sir, stay here, for Christine Daae is here."
"With Eric?"
"With Eric."
How do you know?
I was at the performance, and no one in the world but Eric could contrive an abduction like that. Oh, he said with a deep sigh, I recognized the monster's touch.
You know him, then?
The Persian did not reply, but heaved a fresh sigh.
Sir, said Raoul, I do not know what your intentions are, but can you do anything to help me? I mean, to help Christine Daae?
I think so, Monsieur de Chagny, and that is why I spoke to you.
What can you do?
Try to take you to her, and to him.
If you can do me that service, sir, my life is yours. One word more. The commissary of police tells me that Christine Daae has been carried off by my brother, Count Philippe.
Oh, Monsieur de Chagny, I don't believe a word of it.
It's not possible, is it?
I don't know if it is possible or not. But there are ways and ways of carrying people off. And Monsieur le Comte Philippe has never, as far as I know, had anything to do with witchcraft.
Your arguments are convincing, sir, and I am a fool. Oh, let us make haste. I place myself entirely in your hands. How should I not believe you when you are the only one to believe me, when you are the only one not to smile when Eric's name is mentioned?
And the young man impetuously seized the Persian's hands. They were ice cold.
Silence,
said the Persian, stopping and listening to the distant sounds of the theatre. We must not mention that name here. Let us say he and him, then there will be less danger of attracting his attention.
Do you think he is near us?
It is quite possible, sir, if he is not at this moment with his victim in the house on the lake.
Ah, so you know that house too.
If he is not there, he may be here, in this wall, in this floor, in this ceiling.
Come.
And the Persian, asking Raoul to deaden the sound of his footsteps, led him down passages which Raoul had never seen before, even at the time when Christine used to take him for walks through that labyrinth. If only Darius has come, said the Persian.
Who is Darius?
Darius? My servant. They were now in the center of a real deserted square, an immense apartment ill-lit by a small lamp. The Persian stopped Raoul and, in the softest of whispers, asked, What did you say to the commissary?
I said that Christine Daae's abductor was the Angel of Music, alias the Opera Ghost, and that the real name was
Hush. And did he believe you?
No.
He attached no importance to what you said?
No.
He took you for a bit of a madman?
Yes.
So much the better, sighed the Persian. And they continued their road. After going up and down several staircases, which Raoul had never seen before, the two men found themselves in front of a door, which the Persian opened with a master key. The Persian and Raoul were both, of course, in dress clothes. But whereas Raoul had a tall hat, the Persian wore the astrakhan cap, which I have already mentioned. It was an infringement of the rule which insists upon the tall hat behind the scenes, but in France foreigners are allowed every license, the Englishman his travelling cap, the Persian his cap of astrakhan.
Sir, said the Persian, your tall hat will be in your way. You would do well to leave it in the dressing room.
What dressing room? Asked Raoul.
Christine Daae's.
And the Persian, letting Raoul through the door which he had just opened, showed him the actress's room opposite.
They were at the end of the passage, the whole length of which Raoul had been accustomed to traverse before knocking at Christine's door.
How well do you know the opera, sir?
Not so well as he does, said the Persian modestly. And he pushed the young man into Christine's dressing room, which was as Raoul had left it a few minutes earlier.
Closing the door, the Persian went to a very thin partition that separated the dressing room from a big lumber room next to it.
He listened and then coughed loudly. There was a sound of someone stirring in the lumber room, and, a few seconds later, a finger tapped at the door.
"Come in," said the Persian.
A man entered, also wearing an astrakhan cap and dressed in a long overcoat. He bowed and took a richly carved case from under his coat, put it on the dressing table, bowed once again, and went to the door.
"Did no one see you come in, Darius?"
"No, master."
"Let no one see you go out."
The servant glanced down the passage and swiftly disappeared. The Persian opened the case. It contained a pair of long pistols.
When Christine Daae was carried off, sir, I sent word to my servant to bring me these pistols. I have had them a long time, and they can be relied upon.
Do you mean to fight a duel?
Asked the young man. It will certainly be a duel which we shall have to fight, said the other, examining the priming of his pistols. And what a duel! Handing one of the pistols to Raoul, he added, In this duel we shall be 2-1, but you must be prepared for everything, for we shall be fighting the most terrible adversary that you can imagine. But you love Christine Daae, do you not?
I worship the ground she stands on. But you, sir, who do not love her, tell me why I find you ready to risk your life for her. You must certainly hate Eric.
No, sir, said the Persian sadly, I do not hate him. If I hated him, he would long ago have ceased doing harm.
Has he done you harm?
I have forgiven him the harm which he has done me.
I do not understand you. You treat him as a monster. You speak of his crime. He has done you harm, and I find in you the same inexplicable pity that drove me to despair when I saw it in Christine.
The Persian did not reply. He fetched a stool and set it against the wall facing the great mirror that filled the whole of the wall space opposite. Then he climbed on the stool and, with his nose to the wallpaper, seemed to be looking for something. Ah, he said after a long search, I have it. And, raising his finger above his head, he pressed against the corner in the pattern of the paper. Then he turned round and jumped off the stool. In half a minute, he said, we shall be on his road. And crossing the whole length of the dressing room, he felt the great mirror. No, it is not yielding yet, he muttered.
Oh, are we going out by the mirror? Asked Raoul, like Christine Daae.
So you knew that Christine Daae went out by that mirror?
She did so before my eyes, sir. I was hidden behind the curtain of the inner room, and I saw her vanish, not by the glass, but in the glass.
And what did you do?
I thought it was an aberration of my senses, a mad dream.
Or some new fancy of the ghosts, chuckled the Persian. Ah, Monsieur de Chagny, he continued, still with his hand on the mirror, would that we had to do with a ghost. We could then leave our pistols in their case. Put down your hat, please. There. And now cover your shirt front as much as you can with your coat, as I am doing. Bring the lapels forward. Turn up the collar. We must make ourselves as invisible as possible. Bearing against the mirror, after a short silence, he said, It takes some time to release the counterbalance when you press on the spring from the inside of the room. It is different when you are behind the wall and can act directly on the counterbalance. Then the mirror turns at once and is moved with incredible rapidity.
What counterbalance? Asked Raoul.
Why, the counterbalance that lifts the whole of this wall onto its pivot. You surely don't expect it to move of itself by enchantment. If you watch, you will see the mirror first rise an inch or two, and then shift an inch or two from left to right. It will then be on a pivot and will swing round.
It's not turning, said Raoul impatiently.
Oh, wait. You have time enough to be impatient, sir. The mechanism has obviously become rusty, or else the spring isn't working. Unless it is something else, added the Persian anxiously.
What?
He may simply have cut the cord of the counterbalance and blocked the whole apparatus.
Well, why should he? He does not know that we are coming this way.
I dare say he suspects it, for he knows that I understand the system.
It's not turning. And Christine, sir, Christine!
The Persian said coldly, We shall do all that is humanly possible to do. But he may stop us at the first step. He commands the walls, the doors, and the trapdoors. In my country, he was known by a name which means the trapdoor lover.
But why do these walls obey him alone? He did not build them.
Well, yes, sir. That is just what he did. Raoul looked at him in amazement, but the Persian made a sign to him to be silent and pointed to the glass. There was a sort of shivering reflection. Their image was troubled as in a rippling sheet of water, and then all became stationary again.
You see, sir, that it is not turning. Let us take another road.
Tonight there is no other, declared the Persian, in a singularly mournful voice. And now look out, and be ready to fire. He himself raised his pistol opposite the glass. Raoul imitated his movement.
With his free arm, the Persian drew the young man to his chest, and suddenly the mirror turned in a blinding daze of crosslights. It turned like one of those revolving doors which have lately been fixed to the entrances of most restaurants. It turned, carrying Raoul and the Persian with it, and suddenly hurling them from the full light into the deepest darkness. Chapter 20. In the Cellars of the Opera. "Your hand high, ready to fire," repeated Raoul's companion quickly. The wall behind them, having completed the circle which it described upon itself, closed again, and the two men stood motionless for a moment, holding their breath. At last, the Persian decided to make a movement, and Raoul heard him slip on his knees and feel for something in the dark with his groping hands. Suddenly, the darkness was made visible by a small dark lantern, and Raoul instinctively stepped backward as though to escape the scrutiny of a secret enemy. But he soon perceived that the light belonged to the Persian, whose movements he was closely observing. The little red disc was turned in every direction, and Raoul saw that the floor, the walls, and the ceiling were all formed of planking. It must have been the ordinary road taken by Eric to reach Christine's dressing room and impose upon her innocence. And Raoul, remembering the Persian's remark, thought that it had been mysteriously constructed by the ghost himself. Later, he learned that Eric had found, all prepared for him, a secret passage, long known to himself alone, and contrived at the time of the Paris Commune to allow the jailers to convey their prisoners straight to the dungeons that had been constructed for them in the cellars. For the Federates had occupied the opera house immediately after the 18th of March, and had made a starting place right at the top for their Montgolfier balloons, which carried their incendiary proclamations to the departments, and a state prison right at the bottom. The Persian went on his knees and put his lantern on the ground. He seemed to be working at the floor, and suddenly he turned off his light. Then Raoul heard a faint click and saw a very pale, luminous square in the floor of the passage. It was as though a window had opened on the opera cellars, which were still lit. Raoul no longer saw the Persian, but he suddenly felt him by his side and heard him whisper, "Follow me, and do all that I do." Raoul turned to the luminous aperture. Then he saw the Persian, who was still on his knees, hang by his hands from the rim of the opening, with his pistol between his teeth, and slide into the cellar below. Curiously enough, the Viscount had absolute confidence in the Persian, though he knew nothing about him. His emotion when speaking of the monster struck him as sincere, and if the Persian had cherished any sinister designs against him, he would not have armed him with his own hands. Besides, Raoul must reach Christine at all costs. He therefore went on his knees also, and hung from the trap with both hands. "Let go," said a voice, and he dropped into the arms of the Persian, who told him to lie down flat, closed the trapdoor above him, and crouched down beside him. Raoul tried to ask a question, but the Persian's hand was on his mouth, and he heard a voice which he recognized as that of the commissary of police. Raoul and the Persian were completely hidden behind a wooden partition. Near them, a small staircase led to a little room in which the commissary appeared to be walking up and down, asking questions. The faint light was just enough to enable Raoul to distinguish the shape of things around him, and he could not restrain a dull cry. There were three corpses there. The first lay on the narrow landing of the little staircase. The two others had rolled to the bottom of the staircase. Raoul could have touched one of the two poor wretches by passing his fingers through the partition. "Silence," whispered the Persian. He too had seen the bodies, and he gave one word in explanation. "He." The commissary's voice was now heard more distinctly. He was asking for information about the system of lighting, which the stage manager supplied. The commissary, therefore, must be in the organ or its immediate neighbourhood. Contrary to what one might think, especially in connection with an opera house, the organ is not a musical instrument. At that time, electricity was employed only for a very few scenic effects, and for the bells. The immense building and the stage itself were still lit by gas. Hydrogen was used to regulate and modify the lighting of a scene, and this was done by means of a special apparatus which, because of the multiplicity of its pipes, was known as the organ. A box beside the prompter's box was reserved for the chief gas man, who from there gave his orders to his assistants and saw that they were executed. Mauclair stayed in this box during all the performances. But now Mauclair was not in his box, and his assistants not in their places.
"Mauclair! Mauclair!"
The stage manager's voice echoed through the cellars, but Mauclair did not reply. I have said that a door opened on a little staircase that led to the second cellar. The commissary pushed it, but it resisted.
"I say," he said to the stage manager, "I can't open this door. Is it always so difficult?"
The stage manager forced it open with his shoulder. He saw that, at the same time, he was pushing a human body, and he could not keep back an exclamation, for he recognized the body at once.
"Mauclair! Poor devil! He is dead!"
But Mr. Commissary Mifroy, whom nothing surprised, was stooping over that big body. "No," he said, "he is dead drunk, which is not quite the same thing."
"It's the first time, if so," said the stage manager.
"Then someone has given him a narcotic. That is quite possible." Mifroy went down a few steps and said,
"Look!"
By the light of a little red lantern, at the foot of the stairs they saw two other bodies. The stage manager recognized Mauclair's assistants. Mifroy went down and listened to their breathing.
"They are sound asleep," he said. "Very curious business. Some person unknown must have interfered with the gas man and his staff, and that person unknown was obviously working on behalf of the kidnapper. But what a funny idea to kidnap a performer on the stage. Send for the doctor of theatre, please." And Mifroy repeated, "Curious, decidedly curious business."
Then he turned to the little room, addressing the people whom Raoul and the Persian were unable to see from where they lay.
"What do you say to all this, gentlemen? You are the only ones who have not given your views, and yet you must have an opinion of some sort."
Thereupon, Raoul and the Persian saw the startled faces of the joint managers appear above the landing, and they heard Moncharmin's excited voice. "There are things happening here, Mr. Commissary, which we are unable to explain." And the two faces disappeared.
"Well, thank you for the information, gentlemen," said Mifroy with a jeer.
But the stage manager, holding his chin in the hollow of his right hand, which is the attitude of profound thought, said,
"It is not the first time that Mauclair has fallen asleep in the theatre. I remember finding him one evening snoring in his little recess with his snuff-box beside him."
"Is that long ago?" asked Monsieur Mifroy, carefully wiping his eyeglasses.
"No, not so very long ago. Wait a bit. It was the night—of course, yes. It was the night when Carlotta, you know, Mr. Commissary, gave her famous—"
"Coac!"
"Really? The night when Carlotta gave her famous—" "Coac?"
And Monsieur Mifroy, replacing his gleaming glasses on his nose, fixed the stage manager with a contemplative stare.
"So Mauclair takes snuff, does he?" he asked carelessly.
"Yes, Mr. Commissary. Look, there is his snuff-box on that little shelf.
Oh, he's a great snuff-taker."
"So am I," said Mifroy, and put the snuff-box in his pocket. Raoul and the Persian, themselves unobserved, watched the removal of the three bodies by a number of scene-shifters, who were followed by the commissary and all the people with him. Their steps were heard for a few minutes on the stage above. When they were alone, the Persian made a sign to Raoul to stand up. Raoul did so, but as he did not lift his hand in front of his eyes ready to fire, the Persian told him to resume that attitude and to continue it, whatever happened.
"But it tires the hand unnecessarily," whispered Raoul. "If I do fire, I shan't be sure of my aim."
"Then shift your pistol to the other hand," said the Persian.
"I can't shoot with my left hand."
Thereupon the Persian made this queer reply, which was certainly not calculated to throw light into the young man's flurried brain. "It is not a question of shooting with the right hand or the left. It's a question of holding one of your hands as though you were going to pull the trigger of a pistol with your arm bent. As for the pistol itself, when all is said, you can put that in your pocket." And he added, "Let this be clearly understood, or I will answer for nothing. It is a matter of life and death. And now silence and follow me." The cellars of the opera are enormous, and they are five in number. Raoul followed the Persian and wondered what he would have done without his companion in that extraordinary labyrinth. They went down to the third cellar, and their progress was still lit by some distant lamp. The lower they went, the more precautions the Persian seemed to take. He kept on turning to Raoul to see if he was holding his arm properly, showing him how he himself carried his hand as if always ready to fire, though the pistol was in his pocket.
Suddenly, a loud voice made them stop. Someone above them shouted, "All the door shutters on the stage! The commissary of police wants them!" Steps were heard, and shadows glided through the darkness. The Persian drew Raoul behind a set-piece. They saw passing before and above them old men bent by age and the past burden of opera scenery. Some could hardly drag themselves along. Others, from habit, with stooping bodies and outstretched hands, looked for doors to shut. They were the door-shutters, the old, worn-out scene-shifters on whom a charitable management had taken pity, giving them the job of shutting doors above and below the stage. They went about incessantly from top to bottom of the building, shutting the doors. And they were also called the draught-expellers, at least at that time, for I have little doubt that by now they are all dead. Drafts are very bad for the voice, wherever they may come from. The Persian and Raoul welcomed this incident, which relieved them of inconvenient witnesses, for some of those door-shutters, having nothing else to do or nowhere to lay their heads, stayed at the opera from idleness or necessity and spent the night there. The two men might have stumbled over them, waking them up and provoking a request for explanations. For the moment, Monsieur Mifroy's inquiry saved them from any such unpleasant encounters. But they were not left to enjoy their solitude for long. Other shades now came down by the same way by which the door-shutters had gone up. Each of these shades carried a little lantern and moved it about, above, below, and all around, as though looking for something or somebody. "Hang it," muttered the Persian. "I don't know what they are looking for, but they might easily find us. Let us get away quick. Your hand up, sir, ready to fire. Bend your arm. More, that's it. Hand at the level of your eye, as though you were fighting a duel and waiting for the word to fire. Oh, leave your pistol in your pocket. Quick, come along, downstairs, level of your eye, question of life or death. Here, this way, these stairs." They reached the fifth cellar. Oh, what a duel, sir, what a duel. Once in the fifth cellar, the Persian drew breath. He seemed to enjoy a rather greater sense of security than he had displayed when they both stopped in the third. But he never altered the attitude of his hand. And Raoul, remembering the Persian's observation, "I know these pistols can be relied upon," was more and more astonished, wondering why anyone should be so gratified at being able to rely upon a pistol which he did not intend to use. But the Persian left him no time for reflection. Telling Raoul to stay where he was, he ran up a few steps of the staircase which they had just left, and then returned. "How stupid of us," he whispered. "We shall soon have seen the end of those men with their lanterns. It is the firemen going their rounds." The two men waited 5 minutes longer. Then the Persian took Raoul up the stairs again, but suddenly he stopped him with a gesture. Something moved in the darkness before them. "Flat on your stomach," whispered the Persian. The two men lay flat on the floor. They were only just in time. A shade, this time carrying no light, just a shade in the shade, passed. It passed close to them, near enough to touch them. They felt the warmth of its cloak upon them, for they could distinguish the shade sufficiently to see that it wore a cloak which shrouded it from head to foot. On its head it had a soft felt hat. It moved away, drawing its feet against the walls, and sometimes giving a kick into a corner. "Phew!" said the Persian. "We've had a narrow escape. That shade knows me, and has twice taken me to the manager's office." "Is it someone belonging to the theatre police?" asked Raoul. "It's someone much worse than that," replied the Persian, without giving any further explanation. Author's note. Like the Persian, I can give no further explanation touching the apparition of this shade, whereas in this historic narrative everything else will be normally explained, however abnormal the course of events may seem. I cannot give the reader expressly to understand what the Persian meant by the words, "It is someone much worse than that." The reader must try to guess for himself, for I promised Monsieur Pedro Gaillard, the former manager of the opera, to keep his secret regarding the extremely interesting and useful personality of the wandering, cloaked shade which, while condemning itself to live in the cellars of the opera, rendered such immense services to those who, on gala evenings, for instance, ventured to stray away from the stage. I am speaking of state services, and upon my word of honour, I can say no more.
"It's not he?"
"He? If he does not come behind us, we shall always see his yellow eyes. That is more or less our safeguard tonight. But he may come from behind, stealing up, and we are dead men if we do not keep our hands as though about to fire, at the level of our eyes, in front." The Persian had hardly finished speaking when a fantastic face came in sight,
a whole fiery face, not only two yellow eyes. Yes, a head of fire came toward them, at a man's height, but with no body attached to it. The face shed fire, looked in the darkness like a flame shaped as a man's face.
"Oh," said the Persian between his teeth, "I have never seen this before."
Pampam was not mad after all, he had seen it.
"What can that flame be? It is not he, but he may have sent it. Take care, take care, your hand at the level of your eyes, in heaven's name, at the level of your eyes. I know most of his tricks, but not this one. Come, let us run. It is safer. Hand at the level of your eyes."
And they fled down the long passage that opened before them. After a few seconds that seemed to them like long minutes, they stopped.
"He doesn't often come this way," said the Persian. "This side has nothing to do with him. This side does not lead to the lake, nor to the house on the lake. But perhaps he knows that we are at his heels, although I promised him to leave him alone and never to meddle in his business again." So saying, he turned his head, and Raoul also turned his head. And they again saw the head of fire behind their two heads. It had followed them, and it must have run also, and perhaps faster than they, for it seemed to be nearer to them. At the same time, they began to perceive a certain noise of which they could not guess the nature. They simply noticed that the sound seemed to move and to approach with the fiery face. It was a noise as though thousands of nails had been scraped against a blackboard, the perfectly unendurable noise that is sometimes made by a little stone inside the chalk that grates on the blackboard. They continued to retreat, but the fiery face came on, gaining on them. They could see its features clearly now. The eyes were round and staring, the nose a little crooked, and the mouth large, with a hanging lower lip, very like the eyes, nose, and lip of the moon, when the moon is quite red, bright red. How did that red moon manage to glide through the darkness at a man's height, with nothing to support it, at least apparently? And how did it go so fast, so straight ahead, with such staring, staring eyes? And what was that scratching, scraping, grating sound which it brought with it? The Persian and Raoul could retreat no farther, and flattened themselves against the wall, not knowing what was going to happen because of that incomprehensible head of fire, and especially now, because of the more intense, swarming, living, numerous sound, for the sound was certainly made up of hundreds of little sounds that moved in the darkness under the fiery face. And the fiery face came on, with its noise, came level with them. And the two companions, flat against their wall, felt their hair stand on end with horror, for they now knew what the thousand noises meant. They came in a troop, hustled along in the shadow by innumerable little hurried waves, swifter than the waves that rush over the sands at high tide, little night waves foaming under the moon, under the fiery head that was like a moon. And the little waves passed between their legs, climbing up their legs, irresistibly, and Raoul and the Persian could no longer restrain their cries of horror, dismay, and pain. Nor could they continue to hold their hands at the level of their eyes. Their hands went down to their legs, to push back the waves, which were full of little legs and nails and claws and teeth. Yes, Raoul and the Persian were ready to faint, like Pampin the fireman. But the head of fire turned round in answer to their cries and spoke to them. "Don't move! Don't move! Whatever you do, don't come after me! I am the rat-catcher. Let me pass with my rats!" And the head of fire disappeared, vanished in the darkness, while the passage in front of it lit up, as the result of the change which the rat-catcher had made in his dark lantern. Before, so as not to scare the rats in front of him, he had turned his dark lantern on himself, lighting up his own head. Now, to hasten their flight, he lit the dark space in front of him. And he jumped along, dragging with him the waves of scratching rats, all the thousand sounds. Raoul and the Persian breathed again, though still trembling. "I ought to have remembered that Eric talked to me about the rat-catcher," said the Persian, "but he never told me that he looked like that, and it's funny that I should never have met him before. Of course, Eric never comes to this part."
"Are we very far from the lake, sir?" asked Raoul. "When shall we get there? Take me to the lake. Oh, take me to the lake. When we are at the lake, we will call out. Christine will hear us, and he will hear us too, and as you know him, we shall talk to him."
"Baby," said the Persian, "we shall never enter the house on the lake by the lake. I myself have never landed on the other bank, the bank on which the house stands. You have to cross the lake first, and it is well guarded. I fear that more than one of those men, old scene-shifters, old door-shutters, who have never been seen again, were simply tempted to cross the lake. It is terrible. I myself would have been nearly killed there if the monster had not recognized me in time."
One piece of advice, sir, never go near the lake. And above all, shut your eyes if you hear the voice singing under the water, the siren's voice.
But then what are we here for?
Asked Raoul, in a transport of fever, impatience, and rage. If you can do nothing for Christine, at least let me die for her. The Persian tried to calm the young man. We have only one means of saving Christine Daae, believe me, which is to enter the house unperceived by the monster. And is there any hope of that, sir?
Ah, if I had not that hope, I would not have come to fetch you.
And how can one enter the house on the lake without crossing the lake? From the third cellar, from which we were so unluckily driven away. We will go back there now. I will tell you, said the Persian, with a sudden change in his voice. I will tell you the exact place, sir. It is between a set piece and a discarded scene from Bois de Lahore, exactly at the spot where Joseph Bouquet died. Come, sir, take courage and follow me, and hold your hand at the level of your eyes. But where are we? The Persian lit his lamp again and flung its rays down two enormous corridors that crossed each other at right angles. We must be, he said, in the part used more particularly for the waterworks. I see no fire coming from the furnaces. He went in front of Raoul, seeking his road, stopping abruptly when he was afraid of meeting some waterman. Then they had to protect themselves against the glow of a sort of underground forge, which the men were extinguishing, and at which Raoul recognized the demons whom Christine had seen at the time of her first captivity. In this way, they gradually arrived beneath the huge cellars below the stage. They must at this time have been at the very bottom of the tub, and at an extremely great depth, when we remember that the earth was dug out at 50 feet below the water that lay under the whole of that part of Paris. The Persian touched a partition wall and said, If I am not mistaken, this is a wall that might easily belong to the house on the lake. He was striking a partition wall of the tub, and perhaps it would be as well for the reader to know how the bottom and the partition walls of the tub were built. In order to prevent the water surrounding the building operations from remaining in immediate contact with the wall supporting the whole of the theatrical machinery, the architect was obliged to build a double case in every direction. The work of constructing this double case took a whole year. It was the wall of the first inner case that the Persian struck when speaking to Raoul of the house on the lake. To anyone understanding the architecture of the edifice, the Persian's actions would seem to indicate that Eric's mysterious house had been built in the double case, formed of a thick wall constructed as an embankment or dam, then of a brick wall, a tremendous layer of cement, and another wall several yards in thickness. At the Persian's words, Raoul flung himself against the wall and listened eagerly. But he heard nothing. Nothing, except distant steps sounding on the floor of the upper portions of the theater. The Persian darkened his lantern again. Look out, he said. Keep your hand up, and silence, for we shall try another way of getting in. And he led him to the little staircase by which they had come down lately. They went up, stopping at each step, peering into the darkness and the silence, till they came to the third cellar. Here the Persian motioned to Raoul to go on his knees, and in this way, crawling on both knees and one hand, for the other hand was held in the position indicated, they reached the end wall. Against this wall stood a large discarded scene from the Roi de Lahore. Close to this scene was a set-piece. Between the scene and the set-piece there was just room for a body. For a body which one day was found hanging there, the body of Joseph Bouquet. The Persian, still kneeling, stopped and listened. For a moment he seemed to hesitate and looked at Raoul. Then he turned his eyes upward toward the second cellar, which sent down the faint glimmer of a lantern through a cranny between the two boards. This glimmer seemed to trouble the Persian. At last he tossed his head and made up his mind to act. He slipped between the set piece and the scene from the Roi de Lahore, with Raoul close upon his heels. With his free hand, the Persian felt the wall. Raoul saw him bear heavily upon the wall, just as he had pressed against the wall in Christine's dressing room. Then a stone gave way, leaving a hole in the wall. This time, the Persian took his pistol from his pocket and made a sign to Raoul to do as he did. He cocked the pistol. And, resolutely, still on his knees, he wiggled through the hole in the wall. Raoul, who had wished to pass first, had to be content to follow him. The hole was very narrow. The Persian stopped almost at once. Raoul heard him feeling the stones around him,
Then the Persian took out his dark lantern again, stooped forward, examined something beneath him, and immediately extinguished his lantern. Raoul heard him say in a whisper, "We shall have to drop a few yards without making a noise. Take off your boots." The Persian handed his own shoes to Raoul. "Put them outside the wall," he said. "We shall find them there when we leave." He crawled a little farther on his knees, then turned right round and said, "I am going to hang by my hands from the edge of the stone and let myself drop into his house. You must do exactly the same. Do not be afraid. I will catch you in my arms." Raoul soon heard a dull sound, evidently produced by the fall of the Persian, and then dropped down. He felt himself clasped in the Persian's arms. "Hush," said the Persian. And they stood motionless, listening. The darkness was thick around them, the silence heavy and terrible. Then the Persian began to make play with the dark lantern again, turning the rays over their heads, looking for the hole through which they had come, and failing to find it. "Oh," he said, "the stone has closed of itself." And the light of the lantern swept down the wall and over the floor. The Persian stooped and picked up something, a sort of cord, which he examined for a second and flung away with horror. "The Punjab lasso," he muttered. "What is it?" asked Raoul. The Persian shivered. "It might very well be the rope by which the man was hanged, and which was looked for so long." And, suddenly seized with fresh anxiety, he moved the little red disc of his lantern over the walls. In this way, he lit up a curious thing, the trunk of a tree, which seemed still quite alive with its leaves, and the branches of that tree ran right up the walls and disappeared in the ceiling. Because of the smallness of the luminous disc, it was difficult at first to make out the appearance of things. They saw a corner of a branch, and a leaf, and another leaf, and, next to it, nothing at all, nothing but the ray of light that seemed to reflect itself. Raoul passed his hands over that nothing, over that reflection. "Hello," he said. "The wall is a looking-glass." "Yes, a looking-glass," said the Persian, in a tone of deep emotion. And, passing the hand that held the pistol over his moist forehead, he added, "We have dropped into the torture chamber." What the Persian knew of this torture chamber, and what there befell him and his companion, shall be told in his own words, as set down in a manuscript which he left behind him, and which I copy verbatim. Chapter 21. Interesting and instructive vicissitudes of a Persian in the cellars of the opera. The Persian's narrative. It was the first time that I entered the house on the lake. I had often begged the trapdoor lover, as we used to call Eric in my country, to open its mysterious doors to me. He always refused. I made very many attempts, but in vain, to obtain admittance. Watch him as I might, after I first learned that he had taken up his permanent abode at the opera, the darkness was always too thick to enable me to see how he worked the door in the wall on the lake. One day, when I thought myself alone, I stepped into the boat and rowed toward that part of the wall through which I had seen Eric disappear. It was then that I came into contact with the siren who guarded the approach and whose charm was very nearly fatal to me. I had no sooner put off from the bank than the silence amid which I floated on the water was disturbed by a sort of whispered singing that hovered all around me. It was half breath, half music. It rose softly from the waters of the lake, and I was surrounded by it through I knew not what artifice. It followed me, moved with me, and was so soft that it did not alarm me. On the contrary, in my longing to approach the source of that sweet and enticing harmony, I leaned out of my little boat over the water, for there was no doubt in my mind that the singing came from the water itself. By this time, I was alone in the boat in the middle of the lake. The voice, for it was now distinctly a voice, was beside me on the water. I leaned over, leaned still farther. The lake was perfectly calm, and a moonbeam that passed through the air-hole in the Rue Scribe showed me absolutely nothing on its surface, which was smooth and black as ink. I shook my ears to get rid of a possible humming, but I soon had to accept the fact that there was no humming in the ears so harmonious as the singing whisper that followed and now attracted me. Had I been inclined to superstition, I should have certainly thought that I had to do with some siren, whose business it was to confound the traveller who should venture on the waters of the house on the lake.
Fortunately, I come from a country where we are too fond of fantastic things not to know them through and through. And I had no doubt but that I was face to face with some new invention of Eric's. But this invention was so perfect that, as I leaned out of the boat, I was impelled less by a desire to discover its trick than to enjoy its charm. And I leaned out until I almost overturned the boat. Suddenly, two monstrous arms issued from the bosom of the waters and seized me by the neck, dragging me down to the depths with irresistible force. I should certainly have been lost if I had not had time to give a cry by which Eric knew me, for it was he, and instead of drowning me, as was certainly his first intention, he swam with me and laid me gently on the bank. "How imprudent you are," he said, as he stood before me dripping with water. "Why try to enter my house? I never invited you. I don't want you there, nor anybody. Did you save my life only to make it unbearable to me? However great the service you rendered him, Eric may end by forgetting it, and you know that nothing can restrain Eric, not even Eric himself." He spoke, but I had now no other wish than to know what I already called the trick of the siren. He satisfied my curiosity, for Eric, who is a real monster, I have seen him at work in Persia, alas, is also, in certain respects, a regular child, vain and self-conceited, and there is nothing he loves so much after astonishing people as to prove all the really miraculous ingenuity of his mind. He laughed and showed me a long reed. "It's the silliest trick you ever saw," he said, "but it's very useful for breathing and singing in the water. I learned it from the Tonkin pirates, who are able to remain hidden for hours in the beds of the rivers." I spoke to him severely. "It's a trick that nearly killed me," I said, "and it may have been fatal to others. You know what you promised me, Eric, no more murders." "Have I really committed murders?" he asked, putting on his most amiable air. "Wretched man," I cried, "have you forgotten the rosy hours of Mazandaran?" "Yes," he replied in a sadder tone, "I prefer to forget them. I used to make the little Sultana laugh, though." "All that belongs to the past," I declared, "but there is the present, and you are responsible to me for the present, because, if I had wished, there would have been none at all for you. Remember that, Eric. I saved your life." And I took advantage of the turn of conversation to speak to him of something that had long been on my mind. "Eric," I asked. "Eric, swear that—" "What?" he retorted. "You know I never keep my oaths. Oaths are made to catch gulls with." "Tell me. You can tell me at any rate." "Well?" "Well, the chandelier. The chandelier, Eric." "What about the chandelier?" "You know what I mean." "Oh," he sniggered, "I don't mind telling you about the chandelier. It wasn't I. The chandelier was very old and worn." When Eric laughed, he was more terrible than ever. He jumped into the boat, chuckling so horribly that I could not help trembling. "Very old and worn, my dear Daroga. Very old and worn, the chandelier. It fell of itself. It came down with a smash. And now, Daroga, take my advice and go and dry yourself, or you'll catch a cold in the head. And never get into my boat again. And whatever you do, don't try to enter my house. I'm not always there, Daroga, and I should be sorry to have to dedicate my requiem mass to you." So saying, swinging to and fro like a monkey, and still chuckling, he pushed off and soon disappeared in the darkness of the lake. From that day, I gave up all thought of penetrating into his house by the lake. That entrance was obviously too well guarded, especially since he had learned that I knew about it. But I felt that there must be another entrance, for I had often seen Eric disappear in the third cellar when I was watching him, though I could not imagine how. Ever since I had discovered Eric installed in the opera, I lived in a perpetual terror of his horrible fancies, not insofar as I was concerned, but I dreaded everything for others. And whenever some accident, some fatal event happened, I always thought to myself, I should not be surprised if that were Eric, even as others used to say, it's the ghost. How often have I not heard people utter that phrase with a smile? Poor devils! If they had known that the ghost existed in the flesh, I swear they would not have laughed. Although Eric announced to me very solemnly that he had changed, and that he had become the most virtuous of men since he was loved for himself, a sentence that, at first, perplexed me most terribly, I could not help shuddering when I thought of the monster.
his horrible, unparalleled and repulsive ugliness put him without the pale of humanity. And it often seemed to me that, for this reason, he no longer believed that he had any duty toward the human race. The way in which he spoke of his love affairs only increased my alarm, for I foresaw the cause of fresh and more hideous tragedies in this event to which he alluded so boastfully. On the other hand, I soon discovered the curious moral traffic established between the monster and Christine Daae.